Hey everybody, this is Chris with the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Robinhood.com. I know you have sat back before and wanted to get involved in the stock market. You've wanted to buy stock in Amazon, Microsoft, Google, GM, Facebook, Nike, Visa, Sony, Uber, Walmart, PayPal, Disney, Coca-Cola, GE, Apple, all of these companies that seem to be all over the place, Netflix, all of these ones, man. But you don't know how to go about it. You don't work on Wall Street. Hell, you probably don't even have a college degree. Who cares? It's the 21st century. Don't pay a commission to these losers that'll charge you 15% just to push a button from some high rise in New York City. Go to Robinhood.com today. Set up an account. It's easy as 1, 2, 3. Robinhood.com is investing for everyone. It's the easiest place to learn as you go, learn as you grow. Commission-free investing, plus the tools you need to put your money in motion. Sign up and get your first stock for free. Yeah, certain limitations apply, but that's okay. Break free from commission fees. Like I said, make unlimited commission-free trades in stocks, ETFs, and options with Robinhood Financial. And guess what? As well as buy the hottest cryptocurrencies with Robinhood Crypto. But how much is a Bitcoin today? One Bitcoin is like $33,000 regular dollars. I know you don't have that, but that's okay. Robinhood has fractional shares. You can invest in thousands of stocks and cryptocurrencies with as little as $1. Invest any amount. Choose how much you want to invest, and they will convert from dollars to parts of a whole share. Amazon costs like $3,300 for one share. Don't have $3,300 laying around? Maybe you only have $33? Well, you'll get $33 worth of a $3,300 stock. It's called a fractional share. You can build a balanced portfolio this way. You can invest in a whole wide variety of companies, and you can customize your portfolio with pieces of different companies and funds to help reduce risk. You can also trade in real time. All trades placed during market hours are executed at that time, so you'll always know the share price. You can also keep tabs on your money. You can set up a customized news and notifications to stay on top of your assets as casually or as relentlessly as you like. Controlling the flow of info is up to you. You get to manage your portfolio. You have your portfolio in your pocket, in your smartphone. Everything you need to manage your assets is available in a single app, and you don't have to deal with any loser elitist on Wall Street that isn't any smarter than the person on the corner selling bagels, but because he has a college degree, he gets to charge you money to buy and sell stocks for you? That's nonsense. It's always been nonsense, but now it's the 21st century and you have Robinhood.com, proud supporters of the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. Enjoy the episode. You know, some people think that I tell my story to get praise or to, you know, be on the news or be on shows like this. And you don't realize how difficult it is to become so vulnerable and to open your family up to that scrutiny. But I know how important it is, because when a news segment airs, I get hundreds and sometimes thousands of comments and messages and people who are suffering in silence, and they tell me how much inspiration they get. And so I don't want my struggles and everything that I've suffered to be in vain. Like, I really believe that God gives people struggles and trials to overcome them and then to be that hope and help to other people.
And a Safford City Council member is suspending his campaign for Congress.
A Safford City Councilman has suspended his campaign for Congress after suffering a heroin overdose.
His name is Chris Taylor. You may actually know the name very well. It's been very publicized here in the Arizona media and the Arizona press.
Chris Taylor was running for the Republican nomination to challenge Democrat Tom O'Halloran this November.
And tonight, Chris Taylor says he is seeking treatment for substance abuse.
We first met Chris Taylor in 2017 as we dug in on the opioid opioid problem plaguing the eastern Arizona city of Safford.
In a previous campaign ad, Taylor opened up about his struggles with opioid addiction after two tours in Afghanistan.
Taylor, a veteran who fought off addiction to open his own treatment center, was poised to be the success story for Safford. But he went backwards as old demons resurfaced last week. A relapse that resulted in an overdose. In a statement to suspend his congressional campaign, Taylor was very direct, saying, quote, "I'm not going to hide from this. I'm not ashamed of what happened. I wish to sincerely apologize to the amazing people who have supported me. It's a haunting reminder of a dark past that will always be looking over the shoulder of a bright future."
Everybody, welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. That's me. I am your host, and we're going to continue on in the special series titled 12 Steps to Complete Healing, my personal journey through each step of recovery. We are on step six today. Step six is categorized as a change of heart. Become entirely ready to have God remove all of your character weaknesses. Notice how it says all of your character weaknesses. Not some of your character weaknesses, not half of your character weaknesses, all of your character weaknesses. A true change of heart, true conversion from a prideful, natural man to a vulnerable follower of a higher power, a spiritual minded person that is entirely ready and willing and has surrendered his entire will to remove, to have that higher power remove those shortcomings. There's a quote that says, "The Lord works from the inside out. The world works from the outside in. The world would take people out of the slums. Christ takes the slums out of the people, and then they take themselves out of the slums. The world would mold men by changing their environment. Christ changes men, who then change their environment. The world would shape human behavior, but Christ can change human behavior. May we be convinced that Jesus is the Christ, choose to follow him, be changed for him, captained by him, consumed in him, and born again. You have to be willing to be changed so imperfections may be removed through the power of God. Whether your addiction has been to alcohol, drugs, gambling, pornography, self-destructive eating patterns, compulsive spending, or any other behavior or substance that represents your need to run and hide from the stress or challenges in your life, which we all have, you can come to realize that it all began in your mind and heart. Healing also begins in your mind and in your heart. As you become willing to be changed by coming unto Jesus Christ, you will learn of his power to heal. Taking step six, you increase your commitment to abstain from past addictions through a deepening relationship with the Savior, Jesus Christ, and with the Father who sent him. You decide to become sober-minded. You continue to accept that God must truly become everything to you in order to save you from the weaknesses of thought, word, and action. With this step, I thought that I would retell a story that embodies the a literal embodiment of
of this and how I now can later apply this experience that I had literally in Afghanistan in combat and how I was able to overcome the most serious and horrific situation, and how I can now apply that figuratively to survival from all of the stresses in life, my addiction, my post-traumatic stress, all of that stuff. This is where the story that I'm going to tell was when I first was saved of certain death, literal death. It is, I have told the story before. It's in a narrative form in a creative writing college classes I took several years ago. It was writing reflective essays, and it was an essay that I wrote. I have mentioned this many times, but I spent 18 months total in combat in the Special Operations Forces. And over that 18-month period, the two combat tours, I saw extensive combat action. I was involved in many direct engagements with the enemy, many firefights, many explosions, many close calls. But for whatever reason, this day, this mission, this incident is where most of my issues with post-traumatic stress directly stem from. When I wake up with a nightmare, I don't always see the images of this incident, but I always feel the sensation and the emotional gambit of so many different emotions that I felt simultaneously on this day. And that is where my post-traumatic stress manifest itself, and it's when I have repeated memories, and when I have difficult times and struggles. This is the incident that it stems from, and so other than the fact that this is going to go hand in hand with step six here, it's also going to be therapeutic again to recount this and to go through it and read it to all of you. So without further ado, let me start. It is called Faramuse, A Tale of Survival. I was a junior member of a small two-man tactical psychological warfare team, or PSYOP, trained in the art of negotiation, persuasion, influence, espionage, interrogation, and deception at the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and School, located at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. We were part of the United States Army Special Operations Command, and for the duration of our combat tour in Afghanistan, we were attached to an ODA, which is an Operational Detachment Alpha, also known as the Green Berets. This team was from 19th Special Forces Group. They had accepted us as members of their team after a few months of close living in austere accommodations and frequent extensive gun battles in the lawless and unforgiving Aruzgan province. Originally, we were attached to another team from 3rd Special Forces Group that also consisted of 12 men. But soon after I arrived, 4 members of this team were tragically killed in very brazen attacks by Taliban militants. For an ODA to lose 1/3 of its men in less than a week is utterly devastating and almost unheard of since the Vietnam War. But this is what Faramuse was, a hell of a valley, known for some of the bloodiest battles of the war for Special Forces teams. By 2009, Faramuse had one of the highest casualty rates for Green Berets in the entire 8-year-long war at that point. That third group team left Firebase Anaconda and regrouped to recover. So they were replaced with another 12-man team, but my small team stayed there. 3 months later, it was 15 May 2009. It was the middle of the night in Kandahar, under a brilliantly illuminated full moon. We were on the sprawling Kandahar Air Base to prepare and stage for a level one operation, an air assault from two Chinook helicopters along with a platoon of 40 Afghanistan commandos from the Afghanistan National Army. The mission was clear: hit the target hard and fast with the element of surprise on our side. The target was a high-level Taliban commander codenamed QQ for Quarry Quadratula. Quadratula was responsible for the deaths of the four Green Berets in February. For the sake of perspective, the mission to kill Osama bin Laden was the same as this one, albeit our target was of a far less value. But to us, this was just as big. We desired revenge for the taking of our four brothers who had loving families. Four beautiful wives suddenly had no husbands, and many children between the ages of 5 months to 16 years were all at once fatherless. We were wheels up shortly after 1 a.m. on the 15th of May, 2009. The helicopter flight from Kandahar to Faramuz was roughly 45 minutes long. The mood was dim and silent in the helicopter. Having too much time to contemplate everything, I thought about what job I had to accomplish. I thought about my family and pondered my own mortality. I considered a million possibilities of things that could go wrong on such a dangerous mission, and each scenario played out in my mind. At times, Murphy's Law had proven to be a very formidable foe, I joked to myself. Nevertheless, being assured that God was firmly on our side, I quietly closed my eyes and turned my iPod on. While drifting off to a safer place in my mind, I listened to The Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel on repeat and began daydreaming of summer vacations as a kid, cruising the north shore of Oahu with my parents' vast classic rock library as the soundtrack. A few moments later, I was jolted awake by the elbow of a man sitting next to me, alerting me that the red light in the helicopter door had come on, indicating that we were 15 minutes until touchdown. The nerves began biting the back of my neck. While I had been in Afghanistan for 3 months already, I hadn't been on such a dangerous mission as this. I had no idea what to expect, and the fear was overwhelming. In the 3 short months, I had already seen enough war. I had already had some close calls, and I yearned for the day that I was safe and sound back in the United States of America. My heart and soul were already damaged by 3 months filled with senseless violence. The passion I had developed for conducting my distinctive trade and the compassion for the innocent women and children of Afghanistan is what kept me going. I learned to rely on the intoxicating adrenaline of the bullets and bombs erupting too close for comfort to carry me through the fire and safely to the other side. Flying in the night in the dark night sky at a relatively low altitude with the ramp of the Chinook helicopter down was quite a rush. The brisk middle of the night breeze brought a soothing and welcoming sensation in the middle of the cruel, sweltering Afghan summer. Most of our work was done at night when the rest of the country was asleep. Relying on our superior night vision technology and depending on the element of surprise to gain a swift tactical advantage on our targets were essential to our success. As we cleared the vast mountain range and began to descend into the Faramuz Valley, we began receiving sporadic small arms fire along with several rocket propelled grenades. The seasoned and skillful pilots began to bank hard left and then hard right, flying erratically to avoid being shot down. My body to brace myself sufficiently to avoid being thrown violently to the ground. In a very similar mission, a short time later, a Chinook carrying 30 or so special operators from SEAL Team 6 was shot down very near this location, killing everyone on board. So the danger was extremely real and tremendously terrifying. Due to such intense enemy activity, the pilot was incapable of inserting us close enough to the targeted compound without a high probability of being shot down. Instead, we were dropped some 600 meters away, right in the middle of a bowl-like canyon, with the high ground surrounding us, putting us at a severe disadvantage. We did have a huge benefit of ISR assets, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance overhead. A Predator drone, armed with Hellfire missiles, relaying information to us on the ground, and a Spectre C-130 gunship covering our movement, a rarity in Afghanistan, where dedicated air assets were scarce, and usually only available when a unit was under intense enemy attack, but also reserved for high-level operations such as this one. Over the radio, the call came that there were multiple squirters leaving the targeted compound, a term used to describe people fleeing from the scene. There were also reports of multiple spotters perched high atop the steep hills. After positive identification that these men indeed had weapons and now were firing on our position, the C-130 gunship promptly began shelling the enemy fighters with howitzer 105mm rounds, quelling the situation slightly, allowing us some room to breathe. The sound of the shells exploding in the Bull Canyon was unforgettable. The deafening echo lingered for what seemed like 10 minutes. At this point, it was a foregone conclusion that our high-value target was able to escape unharmed. If we were trying to sneak up on him, we were doing a poor job. The ODA intelligence chief and I had the daunting task to hastily interrogate and gather atmospherics and PSYOP-relevant information from the men left behind. I also questioned some of the neighbors, but the mission was mostly a failure. We all assumed that the helicopters would simply come back and pick us up and take us back safely to the relative security of our firebase, making for a short day at the office. After a few tedious hours of monotonous searching of the compounds, along with the neighboring mud huts, we called to be picked up. The answer we received back was an astounding no. The sun had begun to rise, and our taxi, the 160th Special Operation Aviation Regiment, nicknamed the Night Stalkers. Apparently, they strictly adhered to this nickname and refused to come back to get us, citing the enemy activity in the area was too substantial, and because the sun was rising, it was just too risky to come back. At this time, we also lost our ISR assets as they ran out of fuel and had to return to their airbase. We were now all alone. Our firebase in the small village of Kazaruzgan was approximately 15 kilometers away as the crow flies. An inexperienced map reader would conclude, that's not far at all. However, this was the mountains of Uruzgan province, one of the most rugged and unforgiving mountainous terrains in all of Afghanistan. There were no straight lines to be walked anywhere. So with nearly 70 pounds of gear on our backs, and with our roughly 30 pound armor girded about our exhausted bodies, we rested for several minutes and then began our long hump home. At around 6 a.m., with the sun just about fully risen, we were patrolling the countryside when suddenly an automatic rifle with a distinct burst, made only by the Russian-made AK-47, scattered several rounds around our position. We were ambushed from a nearby ridgeline, and the rounds cracked by my head. When bullets narrowly miss you, there's a distinct and eerie whip and cracking sound, very different than when they impact a distance away. The enemy fighters had barely missed ruining my day and probably ending my life. It's difficult to realize that I was in the crosshairs of an enemy combatant and survived only because he wasn't that great of a shot. Had I been a more highly trained soldier, I would certainly be dead. I immediately returned fire while rushing to a small berm to seek cover, shooting right over Mark's shoulder, hurting his eardrums in the process. He was pissed, but proud at the same time. I had returned rounds downrange accurately before any of the more seasoned Green Berets could. We quickly gained fire superiority and outflanked the militants to the east, killing two Taliban fighters. We did the necessary reporting of the incident and regrouped, preparing to move out again. Only about 13 clicks to go. After what seemed like only a moment of walking, we reached a vast and beautiful apricot orchard. How serene the landscape was. My mind immediately recalled the song I learned in primary at church when I was a small child. Popcorn popping on the apricot tree. I stood amazed at the splendor of the sight before me. Beaming like a small child, I retrieved my camera from my rucksack and snapped a few photos to email home to mom and dad. The sound tactical decision should have been to send several men to the east and up the ridgeline in order to have a tactical advantage and provide overwatch as well as cover fire if required as we moved through the orchard. For some reason though, maybe the allure of the orchard itself, perhaps the already exhausted state of our bodies, no such order was given. Instead, we were ordered to move with a purpose through this green zone as fast as we could so that we could get through to the other side where we would have more cover to move. No more than a minute after the entire element had reached the orchard, I heard a whistling sound, almost like a large bottle rocket on New Year's Eve, followed by a loud explosion and a plume of white smoke near the front of the formation. In a fraction of a second, 55 men hit the ground in unison like a synchronized swimming team. After a moment of complete silence, bullets began to fly in from all directions. All hell broke loose. A textbook three-sided ambush was initiated. An enormous amount of effective enemy fire pinned us down with very little to no cover at all. Instantly, an Afghan commando was shot a mere 10 meters to my left. A few seconds later, another commando was shot 5 meters to my right. There was non-stop machine gun fire all around, both incoming and outgoing. It reverberated like the sustained buzzing of a million killer bees swarming around me. Like in the movies, time seemed to slow down as my body and mind tried to deal with the shock and awe of the reality of the moment. It took me a short while to gain my bearings, but I had hit the ground and found cover right away, simply thanks to muscle memory of the over 15 months of intense training conducted before the deployment. After fully grasping what had taken place, I checked on the two men shot to my left and right. "Medic!" I screamed at the top of my lungs, while another battle-tested Afghan commando stood straight up and began slinging lead at a breakneck pace. The barrel of his M240 Bravo machine gun melted before my eyes. These commandos were fearless, or maybe just complete idiots. Several more rocket-propelled grenades impacted feet from my position and whizzed overhead, but the backblast of the commandos' RPGs was what was scary. Soldiers are trained to check behind them, making sure that at least 25 feet is clear so the propulsion of the rocket doesn't injure anyone. At least three were launched with me directly behind them, causing my eyebrows and my arm hair to be singed and disorienting me at the same time. Pure chaos ensued. Men were screaming, "RPGs incoming, seek cover, stay low, return fire, call for close air support now." As one Green Beret took a squad of the Afghan commandos and attempted to flank the enemy, I began to crawl to the thickest tree I could see, the trunk of which was less than 3 feet in circumference, inadequate to provide the necessary cover from the enemy onslaught, but the best available at the moment. After I crawled the 20 meters and got as close to the trunk as possible, the trees began exploding. Branches were falling all over me after being shot off. I suddenly saw nicks forming in the tree trunk I was hunkering under. I thought to myself, "What in the world is that?" "Oh wow," I shouted aloud as I suddenly realized it was bullets hitting the tree trunk inches from my head. A team interpreter, an Afghan national we had nicknamed Chuck, was roughly 5 feet directly in front of me. He was apparently overcome with shock. He was standing straight up, wandering aimlessly, as if he was confused or lost on a leisurely stroll through the lovely orchard. I swiftly crawled the few feet to him and reached out my arm to pull him down. And just then, bang, he was shot. The bullet entered his groin and lodged in his lower spine. My hand was on his belt when he was hit. I thought I wasn't queasy at the sight of blood until I was covered in it. An artery was severed and a reservoir of blood began shooting out like a busted water pipe. My training kicked in, however, and I began to plug his wound. After a terrible struggle, I finally found and clamped down on his femoral artery and called for a medic. We had to get him moved to somewhere safer, to call in a medevac, and to get him out of the kill zone. He was alive, but paralyzed and dangerously low on blood. I picked him up and attempted to carry him in a technique known as a fireman's carry. I made it close to 15 meters when, due to sheer exhaustion, the weight of my own gear and armor, coupled with his nearly 200-pound frame, my legs buckled and my back gave out and I fell, injuring my lower back. As the battle raged on, we waited for the medevac to come pick up our wounded. Our supply of ammo and water was severely depleted, so we ordered what is known as a speedball, a resupply of ammo and water. After 30 frantic minutes of waiting and trying to catch my breath, and not get killed at the same time, the medevac came and tried to land in the area. Taking withering enemy fire, there's no way these helicopters are gonna be able to land, I said to Captain D. To my amazement and wonder, those fearless medevac pilots with the call sign Dust Off came in and took our wounded while kicking off pallets of water and ammo. The scene was one straight out of the Hollywood depiction of the Vietnam tale, We Were Soldiers. It was all very surreal. We had failed to gain fire superiority and desperately needed fighter jets to come and conduct precision airstrikes on the enemy positions to stand a chance against such a textbook ambush. The man for that job is an Air Force JTAC, which stands for Joint Tactical Air Controller. His duty includes requesting and communicating with the pilots in the air, relaying 10-digit grid coordinates of the friendly forces and that of the enemy so that the fighter pilots can drop their bombs effectively. As we waited for the jets, the fighting raged on, taking more casualties and reaching the point of punishing fatigue. I prayed. I returned fire. I kept my head down as low as humanly possible, and I prayed and prayed some more. Huddled next to Captain D, the ODA commander, he put his hand on my back as if to comfort me and yelled over the sound of the machine gun fire. We just gotta hold out a few more minutes. The A-10s will come and save us. Sharing the same small tree for cover, we looked at each other. Just as we could hear the fighter jets enter the airspace above us, we both smiled, and I was comforted by his facial expression of relief, a nonverbal communication that resonated louder than the sound of all the gunfire. Hearing the jet fly by gave me such a boost of energy and eased my worried mind. We would survive this firefight after all. Before long, I wondered, what was keeping the pilot from laying waste to the bastards shooting at us? Captain D and I looked over at the JTAC, who was sitting under a nearby tree looking dazed. Was he hit? I asked, dumbfounded. He's completely out of it, eyes glazed over, staring out into space. What the actual beep? Captain D murmured under his breath, but loud enough that I could hear. We crawled over to him to see what we could do to help him. I waved my hand in front of his face. He didn't even flinch. He could not see a thing. We found out later that he was apparently suffering from something called hysterical blindness. He was unable to overcome the immense fear. He couldn't even utter a single word to the men lying next to him. And we expected him to coordinate the release of thousands of pounds. Of explosive ordnances with the A-10 Thunderbolt fighter pilots flying overhead at 515 miles per hour, 10,000 feet above our heads. When I heard the jets circle around and come back to above our position, I was elated, only to realize nobody was there to communicate with them. My disposition plummeted into the greatest depths of hopelessness. Captain D and I began to shake and slap the JTAC in the face, anticipating that he would surely gain his composure momentarily, at least in enough time to accomplish his job before the jets had to return to base to refuel. This happened to be his first combat experience, and he was failing miserably. Bloody, battered, and nearly broken, we did all we could to hang on and wait for help to arrive. Knowing that I couldn't stay in the same spot for much longer, I got up and moved to a small berm a couple of strides away. It allowed me to gain a better vantage point of the developing battlefield. I was also able to catch my breath for a second as the first lull in enemy fire came. What I saw next is what made me wish that I had kept my head down. Witness something that no human being should ever have to experience. When we come back from this break, we will continue on the story. Step 6, a change of heart, and how I first got to that point. Bloody, battered, and nearly broken, we did all we could to hang on and wait for help to arrive. Knowing that I could not stay in the same spot for much longer, I got up and moved to a small berm a couple of strides away. It allowed me to gain a better vantage point of the developing battlefield. I was able to catch my breath for a second as the first lull in enemy fire came. Troubled by a growing number of civilian casualties that threatened the historically widespread support for operations in Afghanistan, the weeks-old Obama administration had recently implemented new restrictive rules of engagement, prohibiting coalition forces from dropping bombs on areas where civilians could possibly be located. The Taliban, fully aware of the new rules, used this as a way of refuge. After a brief break in action, the enemy combatants began another coordinated attack. This time, they were motivated to bound closer to our feeble position. Risking a sniper shot directly through my head, which seemed to be the signature wound in the area of operations, I gathered the courage to lift my head just slightly over the berm. I really wished I would have kept my head down in the dirt, because what I witnessed next was the most horrifying thing any human being would have to experience. The Taliban fighters were using women and small children as human shields before my very eyes to abet their hasty frontal assault. Thinking we would not be able to return fire, they took the women and children hostage, moving them from house to house, shooting at us while using the children as movable barriers. I was repulsed, horrified. The images were so disturbing, my mind glitched like a computer catching a virus. I was overcome with anger and disdain for these cold-blooded animals. I wanted to kill all of them. The number of emotions that I experienced simultaneously is not accurately expressible. It was too much to handle. I had to immediately suppress what I was seeing and numb myself to the reality before me. Without a doubt, a survival mechanism triggered subconsciously. I was physically, emotionally, and at this point, spiritually drained to an immeasurable degree. I involuntarily blacked the human shield images out of my mind and didn't rediscover it until 2 years later. I felt like I could fight no longer. It's difficult to describe the emotion of truly reaching the point of having nothing left to give. I wanted to go home. I wanted to get as far away from this hell as possible. I had a fleeting thought about just standing up and hoping for an arm or leg wound so that I would be injured just enough to get a ride out of there. In that moment of desperation, it seemed as if time stood still. I looked around amidst the chaos unfolding around me. A million thoughts raced through my mind all at once. I was torn. It was as if I was waging a separate battle within myself while the war went on without me. Would I give up? Would I ever leave this valley? Would my life end at 22, thousands of miles away from home? I didn't want to die. I knew that. But I was exhausted, unable to move. After wrestling within myself for a few moments, I decided definitively right then and there that I would not give up. I reached deep inside and pulled out an inner strength that I did not know was there. I earnestly prayed to my God in heaven and pleaded with him to give me the comfort and the strength that I needed to persevere. I soon felt the rush of a second wind of adrenaline that rushed over me like a hurricane. The deafening static of 50 machine gun firing all at once became inaudible to my ears. It was an answer to my prayer. It was not God's will that I die that day. It was not my fate to perish in combat. I received a refreshing new will to live. I began to fight tooth and nail to just hang on until the American fighter jets arrived. I began to steadily move around, overcoming my crippling fear. I was able to think and see clearly as I directed the guns of the Afghan soldiers so that their aim was more accurate. I accurately returned fire and constantly moved into more advantageous positions. A moving target is harder to zero in on, and I was able to gain a clear picture of the still evolving battlefield. I witnessed an incredible amount of courage and resolve from young Americans from varying backgrounds united in common cause. That sentiment is what motivates me in my constant battle to unite a divided country, to never stop fighting against hyperpartisanship, tribalism, and divisiveness that plagues our country today. Humbly acknowledging my inadequacy, abandoning my stubborn pride, offering sincere prayer, pleading for salvation, making a conscious decision to do whatever it takes to live, enabled me to swiftly change my perspective, which gave me the necessary clarity to be present in the moment and simply do the next right thing. It saved my life that day and many more days to come. It took me 10 years to realize that those same steps, applied at times subconsciously, would propel me through insurmountable trials and life-threatening experiences countless times throughout my life. I screamed with fervor when our jets finally approached the battlefield and released 3 500-pound bombs on the remaining enemy positions. It was the most exhilarating and intoxicating sensation I had ever felt. A culmination of all of the emotions I experienced that day had erupted in a very primitive cry of victory. When it was all said and done, 16 enemy fighters had been killed, including 4 Taliban sub-commanders, with as many as 26 more enemy wounded. 3 partnered Afghan commandos and my interpreter were gravely wounded, and one of those commandos would die a week later of wounds sustained that day. Miraculously, no American was wounded, but unfortunately, a few of the innocent Afghan women and children had also been slain in the fighting. The maimed bodies of small children are scenes that appear in my dreams and occasionally in my mind when interacting with my own beautiful small children. After the fight was over, we still had 10 kilometers of ground to cover through the mountains to reach our base, though it was very difficult. We made it with no further enemy engagement. I went directly into my room and fell face first on my cot and slept for nearly 22 hours straight. I had survived. After making it through this, I felt like I could overcome anything. The next day, a man brought his 3-year-old daughter into the firebase clinic. She was covered in shrapnel wounds from one of the bombs we had dropped. Her mother and 2 siblings had died in the fighting. She was covered with shards of glass from head to toe, required over 70 stitches after all of the glass was removed. She lost one of her eyes, but had all her limbs. Perhaps the most revolting thing of all was that today, this man played the role of a tender, loving, and concerned father, grieving at the loss of his wife and 2 other children. Devastated while attempting to console his wounded daughter who was in severe agony. However, I recognized him as one of the men who had used his own children as human shields just a day and a half earlier. I wanted to slit his throat. I wanted to beat him to death with my bare hands, but I didn't. I had endured and committed enough violence for a lifetime. I quietly went to my room and said a prayer for him. I told God that I needed help to be able to forgive this man for what he did. I was astonished at the audacity. He had to bring his surviving daughter into the clinic to be treated by the very men who he had engaged in the fiercest of battles only 24 hours earlier. This was the reality of Afghanistan. No logic, no normalcy, only war. And war, in my experience, is a living hell. Lots of thoughts and emotions come back to me when I read that narrative. Sometimes I feel like I am back in that reality. When I have nightmares, it's hard to explain, but it's very rarely vivid flashback or vivid depictions of being back in that firefight and seeing those images. That's not the case at all. But what is the case is the sensation and the feelings and emotions that I experienced that day simultaneously. Fear, a crippling anxiety, despair, hopelessness, helplessness, the feeling of being completely exhausted to the point that I can't move anymore. Not only physically, but emotionally and spiritually. Feeling of impending doom. That feeling of reaching a point where not only do you think that you can die, or maybe you might die, but resigning the fact that I'm dead. I'm dying. I'm not gonna survive this. That's what I feel in my nightmares. Sometimes I don't even remember the images that I see in the nightmares. I wake up sweating and my heart beating, and I am just that overwhelming feeling of hopelessness. And those feelings are more acute and more keenly felt right during the times of my relapse. The nightmares are constant. And even though I know that the heroin is not gonna help, it's actually gonna become the problem. Subconsciously, almost, I move to that familiar comfort, even though I know that that comfort is going to be temporary, and that temporary comfort is going to turn into the whole problem. And maybe that's part of why I relapse. Because I know that problem. I know how to fix that problem. It's simple. I simply need to find more heroin or more money to buy heroin before that withdrawal sickness overcomes me. Talked about it several episodes ago, one of the first episodes that I did with video. But now today, nearly a year after my relapse and overdose and gaining the solid foundation and the tools that I now have to cope with when these feelings happen. Because they do, they don't just disappear. I think when we talk about the healing power of the steps of recovery, the healing power of turning your life over to the Savior, Jesus Christ, it's not just magic. It doesn't just erase all of those burdens. But what it does is give me a solid foundation. It gives me an avenue that I can effectively push those overwhelming burdens onto the Savior's back. Because when he knelt in the Garden of Gethsemane and he took upon himself all of mankind's pains, sins, struggles, afflictions, he took that. He felt that. He felt my feelings of hopelessness and despair. He put that on himself. And so now, when I feel those overwhelming feelings coming back, I know that I have to stand my ground and have that same commitment that I had that day when I was faced with that existential threat. Was I going to give up, or was I going to fight with every ounce left? But that day, was I alone? Was I the lone survivor there fighting all of these Taliban fighters by myself? No. I had all of my brothers around me. I had the wrath of God, the American firepower, dropping laser-guided bombs, rescuing me, saving me, sustaining me, giving me that space that I could breathe and that I could move to a more advantageous position. That's all that's happening when I hit my knees in complete humility and sincerity and commitment. And I ask God to help me. Don't take me out of the fight. Don't remove me and put me in some utopia somewhere, because that's not reality. Strengthen me, comfort me, temper me. That refiner's fire, who we often speak about, where God is allowing these horrendous trials to mold and shape us into stronger, better people, so that we can learn to rely on His help, so that we can gain a solid foundation, we can learn and grow and progress and become more like His Son, Jesus Christ, so that when somebody else comes along that is in that despair, in that hopelessness that I have once experienced, I am able to be a tool in God's hand to help that person. But when you overcome those things, and when you provide help to other people, it's exhilarating, it's therapeutic, it's fulfilling. But you cannot allow that pride to come in and say, I did it. I beat that. I triumphed. And I'm so strong that I'm helping other people. I know that's human nature to do that. And that's where I've gone wrong every time. there's no element of pride that is okay. I realize today that I simply have been blessed, and God has blessed me and has been favorable to me. And that's the only reason that I'm alive. Because I should be dead 100 times over. And each time I've reached that point of no return, that point where I cannot move another inch, that point where my pride is non-existent, where I am completely humble. And God has given me these experiences because without them, I wouldn't be able to sufficiently humble myself. Because the natural man in me, in all of us, is an enemy to God. So the whole point of being here on this earth is to learn to put off that natural man, to learn to rely on His power, to learn to be sufficiently humble at all times and in all things, and to help other people so that they can get from where you once were to where you are and further down the path. This is finally so clear to me. And every day I have to wake up and I have to remind myself of that. Because if any time goes by that I don't remember that natural man starts coming back and that pride starts seeping in. And then I'm already halfway down the wrong path. This change of heart is what is talked about in step 6. After the confessions, after the humbling yourself, or being humbled, after a rigorous emotional and spiritual cleansing, you become entirely ready to have God remove all of your character weaknesses. And my character weaknesses are those things that I just talked about. That pride. Most of us were amazed at the transformation in ourselves after steps 4 and 5. We prayed more intently. We pondered more regularly. We kept a journal more consistently. In my case, a podcast. We prepared to make and keep sacred covenants by attending sacrament meeting each week. As we took step 5, many of us met with our bishops and we sought help and repentance. Most of us found our addictions tempted us less intensely and less often. Some of us were already free from our addictions. With such mighty changes in our behavior and our lives, some of us wondered why we need more steps. I've overcome this. Why do I need to keep going on? Why do I need to keep doing these steps? Why do I need to go to step 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 or 11 or 12? Why do I need to continue? Why do I need to go back and continuously work steps 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5? Why? I've been healed. As time passed, though, we noticed that abstinence seemed to make our character weaknesses more visible, especially to ourselves. We tried to control our negative thoughts and feelings, but they continued to reappear, haunting us and threatening our new lives of abstinence. Those who understood the spiritual implications of recovery urged us to recognize that while the outward changes in our lives were wonderful, the Lord wanted to bless us even more Our friends helped us see that if we wanted to not only avoid our addictions, but actually lose the desire altogether to return to them, we had to experience a change of heart. This change of heart or desire is the purpose of step six. How, you may cry. How can I even begin to accomplish such a change? Don't be discouraged by those feelings. Step six, like the steps before it, may feel like an overwhelming challenge. As painful as it may be, you have to admit, as we did, that recognizing and confessing your character weaknesses in steps four and five did not necessarily mean that you were ready to give them up. You may realize that you still cling to old ways of reacting and to coping with stresses in life. Maybe even more so now that you have let go of your addictions. Probably the most humbling thing to acknowledge is that you still harbor a prideful desire to change without the help of God. You forget those spiritual moments. You forget what got you to where you are. Step six means surrendering to God all the remnants of pride and self-will. Like steps one and two, step six requires you to humble yourself and admit your need for the redeeming and transforming power of Christ. After all, his atoning sacrifice has enabled you to accomplish each step to this point. Step six is no exception. As you come unto Jesus Christ, seeking help with this step, you will not be disappointed. If you trust in him and have patience with the process, you will see your pride gradually replaced by humility. He will wait patiently for you to weary of your own unaided effort to change. And as soon as you turn to him, you will witness once again his love and power on your behalf. Your resistance to letting go all of the old patterns of behavior will be replaced with an open mind as the Spirit gently suggests a better way of living. Your fear of change will diminish as you realize that the Lord understands the pain and hard work that it requires. As the process of coming under Christ takes hold in your heart, you will find the false beliefs that fueled negative thoughts and feelings gradually replaced by truth. You will grow in strength as you continue to study the Word of God and ponder its personal application in your life. Through the testimonies of others, the Lord will help you learn the truth that you are not, that none of us are beyond His power to heal. The desire to blame others for the condition of your character or to rationalize your way out of a change of heart will be replaced by the desire to be accountable to him and submissive to his will, to be transparent, to be honest, to be open, to be accountable. The Lord wants you to bless you with a change of disposition that will unite you with him in mind and heart, just as he is united with God the Father. He wants to give you rest from isolation. The isolation from God that caused the fears which contributed to your addiction. He wants to make the atonement effective in your life here and now. And as you yield to the promptings of the Spirit and look for the Savior for salvation, not only from addiction, but from all of your character weaknesses, you can be assured that a new disposition or character will grow out of your willing heart, a growing desire to be sanctified and to be lifted only through the power of God. That is step six, a change of heart. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. This is Chris with the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. Today's episode is brought to you by Freshly.com. Quality meals delivered right to your door. Get $40 off your first 2 weeks. Go to Freshly.com. Let Freshly do the cooking for you. With Freshly, you can choose from a variety of delicious, fresh, and healthy chef-cooked meals, which are delivered right to your door. All you have to do is heat for 3 minutes, making mealtime and cleanup easier than before. You know, if your family's like mine, things get a little hectic, especially during school and sports seasons. Freshly will send you freshly cooked meals to your door, not frozen. They'll be fresh. Put them in the refrigerator, heat them up, and they are amazing. They do not taste like TV dinners. They taste like real home-cooked meals, and they are delivered directly to your door. You pick your meals from the constantly rotating weekly menu of 30-plus different gluten-free options. All of your meals are prepared and cooked by professional chefs and delivered fresh, never frozen. No shopping, no chopping, no cleanup. Freshly chefs take care of the meal prep for you, from perfecting the meals on your weekly menu to sourcing the best ingredients. And there's nothing artificial about it. They use only high-quality ingredients to make fresh meals. No artificial preservatives or colors, no added refined sugars, and no gluten. Just nutrient-rich food you can feel good about. Heat, eat, enjoy. Save an hour on dinner by heating one of their fully prepared nutritious meals in just 3 minutes. What are you going to do with all that saved time? Let them do the shopping, the prepping, and cooking for you. For customers like you, Freshly has a limited special time offer. 2 weeks of dinners cooked by their chefs for $40 off. It's normally $56.94 per week. Go to Freshly.com today. Actually, go to try.freshly.com for the special offer, limited time only. try.freshly.com. try.freshly.com.